This deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted, you know, just like the real thing. You can check it out at CertFuel.com.
It's honestly a great resource.
Right. So, I mean, let's just get into it. Mm-hmm. You know, usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there is this comforting expectation of absolute precision.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Like, it's like engineering. Yeah. You know, you fall off your bike, your arm really hurts, you go to the hospital, and the x-ray shows that jagged white line on your ulna.
Right. The doctor just points at the screen and says, look, there it is.
Exactly. It's totally binary.
Yeah.
The bone is either broken or it isn't. The visual evidence is just right there in front of you.
It's clean.
It's super clean.
Yeah.
But then you step out of the hospital and into the world of finance, specifically the sprawling, just incredibly intricate world of fixed income securities.
And suddenly that x-ray machine is completely broken.
Completely broken. We are looking at a landscape that is honestly incredibly murky. I mean, if you buy a stock, you own a piece of a company. Simple.
Right. You get a share.
But a bond. A bond is not just a piece of paper. It is a living, breathing, legal contract that constantly morphs and changes based on, well, who issued it, what the global economy is doing, how human beings behave when interest rates move.
And perhaps most terrifyingly, how the IRS feels about it on any given Tuesday.
Oh, absolutely. The IRS is the final boss here.
It really is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters. You can't just look at a bond's yield and understand its health or its danger.
No, you really can't.
You have to understand the underlying anatomy of the contract. And that is exactly why we are here today. We are going to clear those waters up completely.
Our mission for this session is just laser focused on fixed income securities. I want to set the big picture right out of the gate for you. Today, we are answering the foundational questions.
Well, what and the who?
Exactly. What are bonds, who issues them, and how are they taxed? We're basically putting the pieces on the chessboard so you understand the fundamental identity of these instruments.
And, you know, I think it's equally important to define what we are not doing today.
Good point. What are we skipping?
We are not going to drag you through the heavy secondary market mathematics of bond pricing or yields to maturity.
Or no calculators needed today.
Right. No complex calculations of premium versus discount amortization. That is a completely different session. Today is strictly about identity and characteristics.
Right.
If you pick up a security, we want you to know exactly what it is, who backed it, and, well, where the hidden trapdoors are.
Which is perfect, because for you listening, yes, you pacing around your living room or driving to work right now, prepping for the Series 65, you already know that passing this exam requires deep structural understanding.
You cannot just brute force memorize a deck of flashcards and expect to pass.
They will catch you. The exam writers are just way too smart for that. They will test you on why a rule exists, not just what the rule is.
Because if you don't understand the why, an unfamiliar scenario will completely derail you.
Exactly. So to keep us grounded in reality and to make sure these abstract concepts actually stick in your brain, we're going to rely on three recurring fictional characters.
I love these guys. They are avatars of risk and reward.
I think using these characters is the best way to decode fixed income. It takes a dry concept like credit risk and attaches it to human emotion.
Which is how markets actually function anyway.
Right. So first up, we have cautious Carl. Carl is terrified of losing even a single penny of his money.
He's the kind of guy who probably sleeps on a mattress stuffed with low-yield government paper.
Literally.
Yeah.
He loves federal guarantees. He absolutely despises risk. And his only goal in life is to know his principal is perfectly safe from default.
Then on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, we have high-yield Harriet.
Oh, Harriet.
Harriet is an absolute financial adrenaline junkie. She is constantly chasing the biggest possible return and has a habit of completely ignoring flashing neon danger signs.
If there is a metaphorical cliff in the bond market, Harriet is base jumping off it just to scrape an extra 2% of yield.
She is a menace to her own portfolio, but we love her.
We really do. And finally, we have Mayor Martha. Martha is a local politician.
Always trying to get reelected.
Always. She's relentlessly trying to fund new projects for her town. A new monorail system, maybe a sprawling hospital wing, a toll road.
But she is constantly walking this delicate, terrifying tightrope.
Right. Trying to raise millions of dollars in debt without upsetting the local voters who actually keep her in office. We will be using Carl, Harriet, and Martha to stress test all of these concepts.
It's the perfect lineup because it maps directly onto our progression for today.
What's the roadmap?
We are going to start with the safest harbor in the financial universe for cautious Carl.
U.S. government treasuries.
Exactly. Then we'll step slightly out of that bunker into the more complex machinery of agency securities and mortgages.
Okay, a little more risk.
Right. After that, we'll visit Mayor Martha to dissect municipal bonds, head over to High Yield Harriet's playground to examine corporate debt, and finally, we'll open up the spice rack to look at asset-backed and foreign securities.
I am so ready. Let's dive right into Section 1, the Risk-Free Foundation, U.S. Treasuries.
To connect this to the broader economic reality, Treasury securities carry the full faith and credit of the U.S. government.
Which is a phrase you'll see constantly on the exam.
Constantly. For the strict purposes of the Series 65 exam, you must treat these instruments as having absolutely no default risk.
Mm-hmm.
None.
Zero.
They are the absolute baseline, the benchmark, the risk-free rate that every single other investment on the planet is measured against.
Because, I mean, realistically, if the United States government defaults on its debt, the entire global financial system collapses.
Oh, completely.
Like, we're all probably trading bottle caps for canned beans anyway, right? Your brokerage account balance isn't going to matter much in a post-apocalyptic wasteland.
That is exactly the grim underlying logic. The U.S. government has the ultimate superpower. It owns the printing press for the currency its debt is denominated in.
So they can just print more money to pay you back.
Exactly. Therefore, for the exam, treasuries equal zero default risk. But they aren't a monolith. They come in three primary flavors that you need to be able to distinguish instantly.
Okay, let's hear them.
T-bills, T-notes, and T-bonds.
Okay, wait, let me push back on this right away.
Go for it.
If these are all just loans to the federal government, like if Cautious Carl is just handing a stack of cash to Uncle Sam, why do they have different names?
Yeah, why not just call them all treasuries?
Exactly. Why complicate the terminology? A loan is a loan.
It all comes down to the timeline, the maturity date, and really the specific mechanics of how the government actually pays you for the use of your money.
Okay, break that down for me.
It's about duration and cash flow structure. Let's isolate the first one. T-bills, or treasury bills, these are the short-term instruments. They mature in 1 year or less. You'll see them auctioned in increments like 4 weeks, 13 weeks, 26 weeks, up to 52 weeks maximum.
Okay, so very short-term.
Very. But here is the critical, highly testable distinction. T-bills pay absolutely no periodic interest. Zero.
Wait, hold on. Cautious Carl hands the government his money for an entire year, and he doesn't get a single interest check in the mail.
Not a single one.
Why on earth would he do that? That sounds like a terrible deal.
Because they are sold at a deep discount to their par value.
Ah, okay. What does that mean in real dollars?
So Carl doesn't walk up and buy a $10,000 T-bill for $10,000. He buys it at auction for, let's say, $9,100.
Okay.
He holds that piece of paper for the required time, and at maturity, the government hands him the full $10,000 face value.
Ah, I see.
The $300 difference between what he paid and what he received is his return. It functions exactly like interest, but it's not paid out in little semi-annual checks along the way. It's all captured at the very end.
Okay, that makes total sense. It's like buying a $100 bill for $97, but you just have to wait a year to spend it.
Exactly. Discounted upfront, par value at the end.
Okay. Now, what about the other two? T-notes and T-bonds.
Those are the traditional coupon bearers. T-notes are intermediate-term securities, meaning they mature in 2 to 10 years.
And T-bonds.
T-bonds are the long-haul debt maturing in 20 to 30 years. Unlike T-bills, notes and bonds are issued at par.
So Carl actually pays the full face value up front.
Right. So if Carl wants a $10,000 T-bond, he actually pays $10,000 up front. In exchange for that longer lockup period, the government pays a fixed coupon interest rate semi-annually.
Semi-annually? That's twice a year.
Yes. Every 6 months, Carl gets a very predictable check deposited into his account until the bond matures, at which point he gets his original $10,000 back.
Okay, direct question to you, the listener. Pause what you're doing and think about this scenario.
Put your thinking cap on.
Cautious Carl wants the absolute safety of a government security, but he has a problem. He knows he might need his cash back in about 3 or 4 months to replace a failing roof on his house.
Oh, home repairs. The worst.
The absolute worst. So he needs the most liquid, least volatile government security possible. What specific instrument does he buy?
Think about the timelines we just discussed.
He buys T-bills. Highly liquid, short-term, zero coupon.
Exactly. Because they mature so quickly, their market price barely fluctuates.
Right. There's no time for them to swing wildly.
If you ever see a question asking for the safest, most liquid place to park cash for the short term, T-bills are your textbook slam dunk answer.
Spot on. Now, I know there is a weird quirk with how treasuries are priced.
Oh, yes. Here is where the mechanics of treasuries get slightly weird compared to the rest of the market. It's how they are priced when they are traded in the secondary market.
Walk me through it.
Well, if you look at corporate bonds or municipal bonds, they are typically quoted in fractions of eighths.
Okay, standard.
But treasuries are quoted in 32nds of a percent.
30 seconds. That feels so, I don't know, unnecessarily granular.
It really does sound that way.
Why break a percentage point down into 32 tiny slices? Why not just use decimals like a normal person?
You have to picture the scale of this market. The trading volume of U.S. treasuries is astronomically massive. We are talking about the most liquid, heavily traded debt market on the planet.
Right, trillions of dollars moving constantly.
Exactly. When massive institutional investors like foreign central banks or giant pension funds are trading hundreds of millions of dollars of treasuries in a single block, tiny, microscopic increments in price matter enormously.
A difference of 1/32nd of a percent on a billion-dollar trade is a massive amount of real money.
So the market evolved to use these hyper-specific fractions to squeeze every drop of efficiency out of the trade.
Okay, let me make sure I have the exact math right on this, because I know this visual trick shows up on the exam constantly.
It does. It's a classic visual trap.
If I am looking at a quote screen and I see a treasury bond listed at 98.16 with a colon or sometimes a hyphen between the numbers, that does not mean 98.16%.
Correct. If you read that as 98.16%, you will get the math question wrong. That colon or hyphen is your warning sign.
So what does it actually mean?
98.16 means 98 and 1630 seconds.
Okay, and since 16 is exactly half of 32, that fraction reduces to one half.
Right.
So it's 98.50% of par. So if it's a standard $1,000 par value bond, 98.50% of $1,000 is $985.
Precisely. You have to train your brain. The second you see a colon or a hyphen in a government bond, quote, immediately translate the number after the punctuation mark into a fraction over 32.
Okay, that's a great mechanical tip. Let's pivot and look at a different kind of risk.
Okay, what's cautious Carl worried about now?
Well, Carl loves the standard treasuries because there is no default risk. The government won't go bankrupt. But Carl reads the news. He goes to the grocery store and sees the price of a carton of eggs tripling.
Oh, yeah. Inflation is terrifying for fixed income.
He goes to buy a car, and the prices are astronomical. Carl is suddenly paralyzed by a different monster entirely: inflation.
Also officially known as purchasing power risk.
Right, because a fixed interest check is utterly useless if it buys half as much stuff 10 years from now.
Exactly. What good is a safe 3% return if inflation is running at 6%? You're losing money safely.
Right. So what specific tool does the government offer to fix that anxiety for Carl?
For that exact scenario, the government issues TIPS.
PIPS. What does this stand for?
Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. These are brilliant, highly engineered instruments designed specifically to neutralize purchasing power risk.
Okay, how long do they last?
You can generally buy them in 5, 10, or 30-year maturities. Let's explore the core mechanism of how they actually work, because it's slightly counterintuitive.
Okay, let's break it down.
With TIPS, the coupon rate, the actual percentage you are paid, never ever changes.
Wait, really? Never.
Never. If you buy a TIPS with a 4% coupon, it pays 4% for its entire life.
But how does it protect against inflation if the rate is fixed?
Because what does change dynamically is the underlying principal amount that the 4% is applied to.
Oh, this is a fascinating mechanism. So if inflation rages upward, my core principal balance goes up with it.
Exactly. The principal adjusts semi-annually based directly on the Consumer Price Index, the CPI.
And the CPI is basically a basket of goods, right? Milk, eggs, gasoline, housing. It just measures inflation.
Right. Let's walk through the math. Say you own a $1,000 TIPS with that fixed 4% coupon. You are expecting $40 a year in interest.
Easy math.
But then severe inflation hits. The CPI spikes. The government looks at that and adjusts your principal up to, let's say, $1,050.
Okay, the principal grew.
Yes. And now your fixed 4% interest rate is being calculated on that new higher $1,050 amount.
Which means my actual interest checks get physically larger in dollar terms, even though the percentage rates stayed identical.
Exactly.
That is a beautiful hedge for cautious Carl. His income scales up as the cost of living scales up.
It really is perfect for him.
But wait, let's play devil's advocate for a second.
Let's do it.
What if we hit a weird economic black swan? The economy crashes, nobody is buying anything, and we experience severe deflation. Prices drop across the board.
Okay, deflation scenario.
Does my principal shrink? Like, could Carl end up holding a bond that matures and pays him back less than the original $1,000 he put in?
That is a great question, and it's something a lot of people worry about. But the answer is no. That is the genius of the TPS contract.
Oh, why not?
They come with a built-in deflation floor.
Deflation floor. I like the sound of that.
If we go through a prolonged period of severe deflation and your adjusted principal gets dragged down from $1,000 to, say, $900, the government steps in at the very end.
To do what?
They guarantee that at maturity, you will receive the greater of the adjusted principal or your original par value.
So no matter how bad deflation gets, Carl will never get back less than his original $1,000.
Never. The floor protects his initial investment.
Wow. Cautious Carl is weeping with joy right now. It sounds absolutely perfect. Safe from default, safe from inflation, safe from deflation.
It sounds like a dream.
But, I mean, I know there is a catch. There is always a catch when the federal government is involved. This is a massive exam trap flag, isn't it?
Oh, it is a massive trap. And it revolves around a concept called phantom income.
Phantom income. Just the name alone sounds spooky and bureaucratic.
Yeah.
What exactly is phantom income?
Let's go back to our inflation scenario. Your TPS principal grew from $1,000 to $1,050 because the CPI went up.
Right. On paper, I feel great about my investment growing.
But then the IRS enters the chat.
Oh, no.
The IRS looks at that $50 upward adjustment in your principal and says, congratulations on your economic growth. You owe us federal income taxes on that $50 this year.
Wait, what? Yeah. But I didn't actually get the $50.
Yep.
That money is locked inside the bond. I don't get that principal returned to me until the bond matures in like 10 years.
The IRS does not care about your cash flow problem. They really don't.
That is so unfair.
They treat that annual upward adjustment in the principal as taxable income in the exact year it occurs, regardless of the fact that you haven't received a dime of it in cash.
So it's called phantom income because the tax liability is very real, but the cash generating that tax liability is a ghost. You can't touch it yet.
Exactly. You literally have to write a check to the government today for money you won't see for a decade.
Wow. Okay, so if I am holding TIPS S in a regular brokerage account, I have to literally reach into my own pocket, pull out other cash, and use it to pay taxes on money the government is essentially holding hostage until maturity.
That's the reality of it. It's a huge drag on cash flow.
That is infuriating.
Yeah.
But it is highly testable. Annual taxes on the principal adjustment.
Highly testable. You have to know that term. Phantom income.
Okay, noted.
And that brings us perfectly to another specialized treasury product that also generates phantom income. STRIPS.
STRIPS, which is an acronym, right?
Yes. It stands for Separate Trading of Registered Interest and Principal of Securities.
Wow. STRIPS is much easier to say.
Much easier.
Okay, this concept can be tough to visualize, so I want to use an analogy here for the listener. I want you to imagine a normal 10-year treasury bond, not as a single piece of paper, but as a physical booklet of scheduled cash payments.
Like a physical coupon book.
Exactly, an old school coupon book. If this bond pays interest semi-annually for 10 years, that means there are 20 individual interest checks in that booklet.
Right, two a year for 10 years.
Plus the one giant coupon at the very back for the $10,000 principal repayment. That is 21 separate distinct cash flows over a decade. What STRIPS do is physically unbundle them.
That is the perfect way to visualize it. The government, or a major brokerage firm, literally strips that bond apart.
They tear the pages out.
They tear the pages out of the booklet. They take that one single 10-year bond and transform it into 21 separate individual zero-coupon securities. Each one can be sold to a different person.
So instead of buying the whole bond and waiting 10 years, I could just point to the seventh interest payment, the one scheduled to be paid in exactly 3.5 years, and buy just that one specific payment.
Yes, exactly. You would buy the right to receive that single payment at a deep discount today.
So how does the math work on that?
Let's say it's a $200 interest payment. You might buy it today for $175.
Okay.
You hold it for 3.5 years, receiving absolutely zero periodic interest along the way. And when that date rolls around, you get the $200 face value.
It functions exactly like a giant T-bill.
It does, but it can be created for much longer durations, like 10, 20, or even 30 years out.
Okay, exam trap flag right here. We need to understand the mechanics of risk. Why do STRIPS exist in the first place, and what is the massive danger hidden inside them?
The primary reason they exist is for institutional investors or people who want to lock in a specific known rate of return for a specific future date.
Without having to worry about reinvesting semi-annual interest checks along the way.
Exactly. If you know you need exactly $50,000 for your kid's college tuition in exactly 12 years, you buy a 12-year strip, you know the exact payout.
It's very predictable.
But the massive trap for the exam is all about interest rate risk, also known as market risk. You need to know that strips have the highest interest rate risk, the most extreme price volatility among all Treasury securities.
Really? Why is that? What is the mechanical reason behind that volatility? Is it purely because they are zero coupon?
Exactly. The underlying mathematical concept here is called duration.
Duration. Let's break that down.
Duration measures how sensitive a bond's price is to changes in current interest rates. Think of duration like a physical seesaw. Okay, I'm picturing it. If you hold a normal bond that pays you cash every 6 months, that cash flow acts as a stabilizing weight near the center of the seesaw. It anchors the price.
Right, because you were getting some of your return back early.
Exactly. But a zero coupon bond pays you absolutely nothing until the very last day of its life, maybe 30 years from now. All the weight is at the extreme far end of the seesaw.
So it's completely unbalanced.
Completely unbalanced. Because of that, its price is incredibly violently sensitive to changes in current interest rates.
Right, because if I hold a 30-year strip locked in at 3%, and suddenly the market rate jumps up to 5%, nobody wants my 3% bond.
Why would they? They can get 5% on a new one.
And because I'm not getting any cash flow to compensate me, the market value of my strip has to plummet dramatically to make the yield attractive to a new buyer.
Precisely. Long maturity combined with a zero coupon structure equals maximum interest rate volatility.
It swings the hardest.
If rates move against you, the market value of a strip collapses much faster than a standard coupon paying bond.
Okay, and since it is a zero coupon instrument, meaning you bought it at a deep discount and you're waiting years to get par phantom income strikes again, right?
Yes, it absolutely does.
Let me guess. The IRS makes me calculate how much the bond's value invisibly crept up toward par this year, and I have to pay taxes on that invisible growth.
Yes. The formal term is the accretion of the discount. You are taxed annually on that accreted growth, even though you received zero cash.
So if strips and tips both carry this nasty phantom income problem, where on earth should Cautious Carl actually hold them?
Good question.
If he puts them in a regular brokerage account, he's just bleeding cash every April.
The solution is account structure. He should place them inside a tax-deferred account.
Like what?
A traditional IRA, a 401k, or a Roth IRA. Inside those specific protective shells, the concept of phantom income completely disappears.
Oh, because the IRS isn't looking inside that account year to year.
Right. The IRS can't touch the internal growth of a tax-advantaged account year over year. The tax is entirely deferred until Carl actually withdraws the funds in retirement.
That is a huge structural takeaway. Put the phantom income generators in the tax-deferred accounts.
That's the only way that makes sense.
Okay, before we leave the federal bunker of treasuries, let's nail down the overall tax treatment. If the exam asks about the taxation of U.S. Treasury interest, what is the golden unbreakable rule?
The golden rule is this. Interest earned on U.S. Treasury securities is subject to federal income tax, but it is completely exempt from state and local income taxes.
Federal, yes. State and local, no.
Correct.
Which makes perfect sense. The federal government wants its cut, but it doesn't let the states tax federal debt. That makes treasuries incredibly attractive if you live in a notoriously high tax state like California or New York.
It's a huge selling point for those residents.
Okay, that wraps up our risk-free foundation. Let's step out of the bunker and move into section two, the mortgage machinery, also known as agency securities.
Okay, so if we are migrating from direct hardline treasuries into the world of agencies, we are taking a deliberate step outward on the risk spectrum.
We are adding some risk.
We are. Agency securities are issued by government-sponsored enterprises, or GSEs. Think of these as massive entities originally created by Congress to grease the wheels of borrowing for specific vital sectors of the economy.
And primarily we're talking about the housing market here.
Primarily the housing market.
Right. So we are talking about the classic alphabet soup of acronyms. GNMA, FNMA, FHLMC, better known as Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac.
Ah, yes, the famous trio.
And just hearing those names brings up a massive flashing neon exam trap.
It absolutely does. The psychological trap for the test taker is assuming that because these entities have words like federal or government or national in their titles, they are all exactly as safe as the U.S. Treasuries we just talked about.
But they are not.
They are not.
Okay, listener, direct question for you. Pay close attention to the phrasing here. If the Series 65 exam asks you which of these mortgage agencies has the direct, explicit, full faith and credit backing of the U.S. government, what is the only correct answer you can select? GNMA. Ginnie Mae, that is the only one. GNMA stands entirely alone.
Exactly right. GNMA is a direct, fully owned agency of the federal government. Its guarantee is ironclad.
Just like a treasury.
Just like a treasury. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, on the other hand, are technically publicly traded corporations. They are government-sponsored, but they are entirely separate entities.
So what kind of backing do they have?
They only have an implied moral obligation from the government.
Meaning, the market just sort of assumes, with a wink and a nod, that the U.S. government wouldn't let them go bankrupt because they are too big and too important to the housing market.
Right, too big to fail, essentially. And to be fair, the 2008 financial crisis proved that assumption was mostly accurate.
Yeah. When the housing market collapsed, Fannie and Freddie were on the brink of insolvency.
And the government did step in and place them into conservatorship to save them. But legally speaking, strictly for the exam, you must know they do not possess the explicit legal guarantee that Ginnie Mae has.
And because Fannie and Freddie carry that tiny microscopic sliver of extra credit risk, because they lack the explicit legal guarantee, how does that affect their yield? High yield Harriet isn't going to take on extra risk for free.
She certainly won't. Harriet wants to be paid for her anxiety. Because of that implied status, Fannie and Freddie must offer slightly higher yields than standard treasuries to convince investors to buy their debt.
The fundamental law of finance applies. Risk and return are always inextricably linked.
Always. Now, the most common, highly tested type of security these agencies issue is the mortgage-backed security, or MBS, specifically the pass-through certificate.
I want to make sure the mechanics of this pass-through concept are crystal clear, because it sounds like, well, just complex financial jargon. We need a new analogy.
Let's hear it.
I want you to imagine a sprawling, newly built suburban neighborhood. There are 1,000 houses, each with a front door. Behind each of those 1,000 doors is a family with a mortgage.
Okay, painting a picture.
They all sit at their kitchen tables once a month, pull out their checkbooks, and write a check to their local bank.
But the local bank has a problem.
What's the problem?
They don't want to wait 30 years to slowly get their money back from those 1,000 families. They want their capital back today so they can go issue new loans to the next neighborhood being built down the street.
Because that's how they make their origination fees.
Exactly. So the bank takes those 1,000 individual mortgages, bundles them up into a massive package, and sells that entire package to an agency like Ginnie Mae or Fannie Mae.
Okay, so the agency buys the bundle. Then what?
The agency takes that massive pool of mortgages and creates a security, a giant bond, that is backed by the cash flow from those specific 1,000 houses.
And when you, the investor, buy that MBS, you are essentially buying a proportional slice of that massive mortgage pool.
Right.
I like to think of it like owning a giant bucket at the bottom of a hill. All 1,000 of those homeowners are pouring their monthly payments down the hill.
And where does the agency fit in?
The agency stands in the middle, skims off a tiny administrative fee for organizing the whole thing, and then passes the rest of the rushing water, the cash, straight through into your bucket.
That is a perfect visualization. The cash literally passes through them to you. And here is the first major exam trap flag regarding the mechanics of an MBS.
Tell me.
Think about how homeowners pay their mortgages. Do they pay them twice a year?
No, they pay them every single month.
Therefore, an MBS pass-through security pays its investors monthly.
Oh, wow. That's unique.
It is one of the only fixed income securities that does this. Treasuries pay semi-annually. Corporate bonds pay semi-annually. MBS pay monthly.
And every single check that drops into your bucket contains a little bit of interest and a little bit of return principal.
That's how an amortizing mortgage works.
Which sounds fantastic for someone who needs consistent cash flow. Mm. But this is big, but that human element, the fact that you are relying on regular people making decisions about their homes, introduces a terrifying mechanical flaw.
Oh, yes, it does.
It introduces what I like to call the seesaw of doom.
The seesaw of doom. It's dramatic, but honestly, it's incredibly accurate. You're talking about the dual opposing forces of prepayment risk and extension risk.
Exactly. We have to dive into human behavioral psychology here. Because unlike a regular corporate bond, where a company legally promises to pay you back exactly on a date 10 years from now, homeowners are chaotic. They are unpredictable.
They get new jobs and move across the country. They win the lottery. They unfortunately pass away.
Or, most importantly, they try to save money. So let's break this seesaw down Walk me through the mechanics of prepayment risk.
Prepayment risk rears its head when macroeconomic interest rates drop.
Okay, rates go down.
Let's set the scene. Imagine you own an MBS backed by a pool of mortgages where everyone is paying a 7% interest rate. You are thrilled with your yield.
High yield Harriet is very happy.
Very happy. But suddenly, the economy shifts, the Federal Reserve cuts rates, and current mortgage rates plummet to 4%.
Okay.
Think about the human behavior. What is every single one of those 1,000 homeowners in your pool going
to
do?
Oh, they are going to sprint to their local bank as fast as humanly possible to refinance. They want that 4% rate.
Exactly. They take out a brand new, cheaper loan at 4%, and they use that massive lump sum of cash to instantly pay off their old 7% loan completely.
So as the MBS investor sitting at the bottom of the hill, your bucket suddenly gets flooded.
Flooded with cash.
You get a massive chunk of your principal returned to you way earlier than you ever expected or wanted.
Now, to a novice investor, getting your money back early sounds amazing. Yay, I got my money back. But if I'm High Yield Harriet, why is this an absolute disaster for my portfolio?
Because prepayment risk is essentially just a vicious form of reinvestment risk.
Bingo.
Harriet just got a massive pile of principal handed back to her early. But why did she get it? She got it because interest rates across the entire economy just dropped.
Right.
So Harriet now has to take that pile of cash, go back out into the open market, and try to find a new investment. But the market is now only paying 4% instead of the 7% she was happily enjoying yesterday.
Her high yield stream is destroyed. She is forced to reinvest in a lower rate environment.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Rates drop, people aggressively refinance, you get your money back too early, and suffer reinvestment risk. That is prepayment risk.
That's one side of the seesaw.
Yeah, what is the opposite side? Explain extension risk.
Extension risk is the exact opposite nightmare. It happens when interest rates rise.
Okay, rates go up.
Let's reverse the scenario. You bought the MBS when rates were 7%. But inflation heats up, the Fed panics, and current mortgage rates spike to 10%.
Ouch.
Now look at the homeowners in your pool. Are any of them going to refinance their 7% mortgage to take on a 10% mortgage?
Absolutely not. They are clinging to that 7% mortgage with cold, dead hands. Nobody is moving. Nobody is refinancing. The neighborhood is basically frozen in amber.
Right. The normal flow of prepayments, people moving, upgrading it, slows to an absolute crawl. The MBS ends up lasting much, much longer than you originally projected.
And here is why that hurts. You are now stuck holding a security paying 7%. In a world where new bonds are paying 10%.
You are missing out on the higher yields available in the market because your capital is trapped. Your investment has brutally extended.
Okay, pattern interrupt. I need you to break the fourth wall with me right now.
Listen up.
Stop pacing. Pull over the car if you have to. Write this next sentence down on a sticky note and put it on your bathroom mirror. Prepayment and extension risk move in opposite directions based on interest rates. Falling rates equal prepayment risk. Rising rates equal extension risk. If one goes up, the other goes down. It is a seesaw.
It is absolutely one of the most reliable, consistently tested mechanics on the exam. You have to know the relationship between macroeconomic rate movements and granular homeowner behavior.
Let's wrap up our agency section with their tax treatment. We already established that treasuries are exempt from state and local taxes. What is the tax reality for agency securities?
This requires a direct side-by-side comparison for your notes. Treasuries are exempt at the state and local level. Agency securities, and this includes GNMA, FNMA, and FHLMC, are fully taxable at all levels.
Wait, really? Federal, state, and local?
Federal, state, and local. There is no tax shield.
Taxable at all levels. Got it. So you get a slightly higher yield than treasuries, but the tax bite is bigger, and you have to constantly monitor the seesaw of doom.
It's a trade-off.
Excellent. Let's shift gears entirely and leave the federal housing market. We are traveling to the local level to visit Mayor Martha in Section 3, Municipal Bonds.
Mayor Martha's Toolkit. Municipal bonds, or munis, are debt instruments issued by state and local governments. This could be a state, a city, a county, a local school district, or a transit authority.
Basically, any local entity.
Exactly. And their entire claim to fame, the singular massive reason wealthy investors flock to buy them, is their unique tax advantage.
The interest they pay is generally exempt from federal income tax.
Which is huge.
Which makes them the absolute darling of high net worth individuals. We will get into the math on why that matters so much in a minute. But first, we need to understand how Martha actually raises this money.
Okay, let's look at her options.
She basically has two main types of bonds she can issue. General obligation bonds, which are JUGO bonds, and revenue bonds. Explain the fundamental difference in what is backing them.
Let's start with the general obligation, or JUGO bonds. The name tells you exactly what it is. The municipality is making a general obligation to pay you back, backed by its full faith, credit, and, crucially, its taxing power.
Its taxing power. That's the key phrase.
Essentially, Mayor Martha is standing on the steps of City Hall and saying, we will pay these bondholders back using the property taxes, the ad valorem taxes of every single person who lives in this town.
Okay, let's explore the mechanics of that. If Martha wants to build a massive new high school using a Don bond, why does she almost always have to get voter approval first?
Well, because Mayor Martha is explicitly putting the local tax nibs on the hook.
They are the collateral.
Think about the worst case scenario. If the town's budget falls short and they don't have enough cash to pay the bondholders, Martha is legally required to raise property taxes to make up the difference. The citizens are the ultimate collateral.
Right.
Because of that massive responsibility, the voters have to explicitly agree to take on that financial burden. So the bond goes to a ballot measure.
Vote yes on Measure B to fund the new high school. We see those yard signs all the time during election season. That is a John bond in action.
Precisely.
Okay, so that relies on taxes. What about revenue bonds? How do they function?
Revenue bonds operate in a completely different universe. They are backed only by the specific revenues generated by a specific project or facility.
Give me an example.
Think of a toll road, a new wing of a municipal hospital, or an expansion of the city airport. There is absolutely no taxing power backing it.
So if the project fails?
If Martha builds a toll road and nobody drives on it because they all take the scenic route, the bondholders simply might not get paid. The taxpayers are entirely insulated.
So because the taxpayers aren't on the hook, does Martha need to go through the hassle of getting voter approval for a revenue bond?
Usually, no. Voter approval is bypassed. But because they lack the safety net of property taxes, revenue bonds require much more upfront scrutiny.
What kind of scrutiny?
Before they can be issued, there must be an extensive feasibility study conducted by independent engineers and accountants to prove that the project will actually generate enough money to survive.
That makes sense.
Additionally, they are protected by something called a REIT covenant. This is a legally binding promise in the bond contract that Martha will aggressively raise the tolls, or the hospital bed fees, as high as necessary to ensure the debt service is covered.
Okay, let's compare them side by side from an investor's perspective. If I'm looking at a gorgo bond backed by the entire tax base of a city versus a revenue bond backed only by the quarters thrown into a toll booth bucket, the revenue bond carries significantly higher risk, correct?
Yes, because it relies on a single point of failure.
Right. And because we know the golden rule of finance that risk and yield are correlated, revenue bonds must pay higher yields than go-go bonds from the exact same issuer.
Exactly. If Martha issues a go-go bond and a toll road revenue bond on the exact same afternoon, High Yield Harriet is going to immediately look at the revenue bond because it pays a little more, while Cautious Carl will accept the lower yield of the go-go bond in exchange for the safety of the tax base.
That makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as with everything in finance, there are a couple of weird mutant cousins in the municipal bond family that love to hide in exam questions.
Oh, there always are.
First up, industrial development revenue bonds, or IDRBs. My radar is going off. This is a massive exam trap flag.
It is a classic trap because the name is incredibly deceptive. An IDRB is technically issued by a municipality, yes, but the money isn't used for a public good like a school or a bridge. It is used to build a facility for a private for-profit corporation.
Oh, really? How does that work?
Let's say Mayor Martha desperately wants a giant tech company to bring 5,000 jobs to her town. She issues an IDRB to build a massive state-of-the-art factory, and then she leases that factory to the tech company.
Okay.
The lease payments made by the tech company are exactly what pays the bond interest to the investor.
Okay, so what is the trap for the exam? If it says municipal revenue bond on the label, what is the reality?
The trap is understanding who is actually backing the bond. With an IDRB, the backing comes entirely from the private corporation. Mayor Martha's municipality is just acting as a legal conduit to get a better interest rate.
So Martha's town isn't on the hook if the tech company goes under?
No. The credit rating of that bond is based entirely on the financial health of the tech company, not the town. And here is the kicker. Because this bond ultimately benefits a private corporate entity rather than the public, the IRS might penalize it.
Penalize how?
The interest from an IDRD might be subject to the alternative minimum tax, or AMT, for certain wealthy investors?
Okay, write that down in bold letters. IDRB equals corporate backing and possible AMT exposure. It's a corporate bond wearing a municipal trench coat.
That's a perfect way to describe it.
Okay, what about the really short-term stuff? We see these acronyms. CANS, RANS, and BANS.
Those are municipal notes. They are short-term debt instruments, usually maturing in well under a year.
What are they used for?
They exist to solve a very specific problem. Municipal cash flow deserts.
Cash flow deserts.
Think about Mayor Martha's budget. She has to pay the police officers, the firefighters, and the teachers every single week. But her massive influx of property tax revenue only arrives twice a year, maybe in November and April.
So what happens in July when the bank account is empty but the bills are due?
She faces a cash crunch. She needs a bridge loan.
Exactly. So she issues a TAN.
Yeah.
A tax anticipation note.
Right. She borrows money from investors in July to pay the teachers with the explicit promise that she will pay the investors back the moment the November taxes arrive. It anticipates the taxes.
Makes sense.
Similarly, a RAN is a revenue anticipation note, bridging a gap until federal grants or project revenues arrive. A BAN is a bond anticipation note, providing immediate cash to start construction on a project before long-term bonds can be finalized and sold.
They are simply temporary bridges over cash flow gaps.
Just bridges.
Okay, let's explore a scenario for cautious Carl. Carl wants the tax-free income of a municipal bond, but he watches the news. He sees cities mismanaging funds. He is terrified that Mayor Martha's town might actually go bankrupt and default on its QO bonds.
Cities do go bankrupt sometimes.
Right. What can he do? Does he just have to avoid munis entirely?
No, the market has a solution for his paranoia. He can buy an insured municipal bond.
Insured by who?
These are munis that are backed by a massive third-party insurance company. The deal is simple. If Mayor Martha defaults on the bond, the insurance company legally steps in and makes all the scheduled principal and interest payments to Carl without missing a beat.
Wow, so Carl doesn't lose a dime.
Exactly. This added layer of security usually bumps the bond's credit rating all the way up to AAA.
Okay, but exam trap. Let's test the mechanics of this insurance. Yeah. What exactly does this insurance policy cover? And more importantly, what does it not cover?
That is the trick. The insurance policy only covers credit risk, default risk. It guarantees the scheduled cash flows.
And what does it not cover?
It does absolutely nothing to protect Carl against market risk or interest rate risk.
So let's say Carl buys this AAA insured bond. A year later, global interest rates skyrocket. Because rates went up, the secondary market value of Carl's bond plummets by 15%.
Classic interest rate risk.
If Carl panics and wants to sell his bond right now to get his cash, does the insurance company write him a check to cover that 15% loss in market value?
Absolutely not. The insurance company doesn't care what the bond trades for on the secondary market. They only guarantee that the scheduled interest checks will arrive and that par value will be paid at maturity.
So if Carl sells early at a loss due to rising rates, that is entirely his problem. The insurance cannot prevent market volatility.
That is classic trick question format. Municipal bond insurance protects the investor against all of the following except T. And the answer is always market risk or interest rate risk.
Got it. Okay, let's get to the most important mathematical concept in this section. The mechanism that proves why munis are so powerful. The tax equivalent yield, or TEY.
This is the entire core benefit of municipal bonds. We know the interest is federal tax exempt.
Right.
But if you are staring at a menu of bonds, how do you know if a 4% tax-free muni is actually a better deal than a 6% taxable corporate bond? You can't compare apples to oranges.
Because the taxes distort the real return.
Exactly. You have to convert the tax-free mune yield into a taxable equivalent so you can compare them side by side.
Right. So, direct question to the listener. Put down your pen and do this math in your head with us.
Get ready to calculate.
High-yield Harriet has had a phenomenal year. She is incredibly wealthy and sits in the highest federal tax bracket, let's say 40% for easy math.
Good for Harriet.
She's looking at a municipal bond issued by Mayor Martha that pays a 4.2% tax-free yield. How do we figure out exactly what a fully taxable corporate bond would need to yield to put the same exact amount of cash in Harriet's pocket after the IRS takes its cut? Break down the actual formula for us.
The formula is straightforward algebra. It is municipal yield divided by 1 minus the investor's tax bracket.
Okay, let's plug Harriet's exact numbers in. The municipal yield is 4.2%.
And we divide that by 1 minus 0.40.
And 1 minus 0.40 is just 0.60. That represents the 60% of her income she actually gets to keep after paying 40% in taxes.
Right. So the math is 4.2 divided by 0.60. If you run that calculation, it equals exactly 7.0%.
Wow. Okay, let that sink in. Harriet would need to find a fully taxable corporate bond paying a massive 7% yield just to break even mathematically with Martha's safe, boring 4.2% tax-free muni bond.
Exactly. And this perfectly illustrates the overarching why behind municipal bonds. The higher your tax bracket, the more incredibly valuable tax-exempt income becomes.
What if we did the math for someone else?
If we ran that exact same calculation for someone in a low 10% tax bracket, the tax equivalent yield wouldn't be nearly as impressive. The Mooney wouldn't make sense for them.
But at a 40% bracket, the tax shield is a massive multiplier of value.
It's basically required for high net worth investors.
And one final quick clarification on munis before we leave Martha's Town, because the exam loves to poke holes in blanket statements. Is everything about a municipal bond tax-free? Can I just ignore the IRS entirely?
No, that is a fatal assumption. Only the scheduled interest payments, the coupon, are tax exempt.
What about the rest of it?
The underlying capital of the bond is still subject to capital gains tax.
So if I trade it?
If you buy a municipal bond in the secondary market at a discount for $900, and it matures a few years later at its $1,000 par value, you just made a $100 profit on the principal.
And the IRS wants a piece of that.
Yes, that $100 is a capital gain, and capital gains are always fully taxable. Only the stated coupon interest enjoys the exemption.
Beautiful distinction. Okay, we have survived the local politics of Mayor Martha. Let's leave the realm of government debt entirely and move to Section 4, High Yield Harriet's Playground Corporate Bonds.
Corporate bonds are the fundamental engine of how massive companies raise debt capital.
Right. If a corporation wants to build a new billion-dollar factory, aggressively buy out a competitor, or just stockpile a massive amount of cash to weather an economic storm, they issue bonds to the public.
And unlike munis, corporate bonds are fully brutally taxable at all levels, federal, state, and local.
No tax shields here?
None. They typically pay their interest semi-annually, just like treasuries, and they are negotiable, meaning they can trade freely and easily in the secondary market between investors.
And when you buy a corporate bond, you aren't just buying a handshake promise. You are entering into a massive, complicated, legally binding contract called the indenture.
The indenture is the absolute rule book of the bond. Picture a 500-page ancient legal tome.
I'm picturing it. What's inside?
It explicitly spells out everything. The coupon rate, the exact maturity date, what specific corporate assets are pledged as collateral, and any covenants.
Wait, what is a covenant? That sounds like something from an Indiana Jones movie.
Covenants are basically legally binding promises the company makes to the bondholders to ensure they don't do anything stupid that would jeopardize repayment.
Like what?
Well, there are positive covenants, like we promise to maintain a cash reserve of at least $50 million.
Okay.
And there are negative covenants, like we promise we will not issue any more senior debt until this current bond is fully paid off.
Got it. Rules of the game.
The indenture also appoints a trustee, usually a major commercial bank, whose sole job is to monitor the corporation and represent the bondholders' interests in case the company starts acting sketchy or violates those covenants.
Now, unlike U.S. Treasuries, corporate bonds have real, palpable, terrifying default risk. Companies go bankrupt and vanish all the time. Blockbuster, Toys R Us. The list is endless.
Very true.
So we can't just trust them. We rely on independent rating agencies to grade them. Moody's, Standard & Poor's, Fitch. And there's a very specific, invisible dividing line in those ratings that you must have memorized for the exam.
The BBB line for S&P and Fitch, which is equivalent to Ba3 for Moody's.
BBB and Ba3.
Yes. That specific tier is the exact legal border between investment grade bonds and high yield or junk bonds.
So anything rated BBB or higher is okay. BBB, AA, AAA is investment grade.
These are the blue chip companies.
Cautious Carl will only buy these because the default risk is statistically very low.
But anything rated BB plus or lower is officially high yield Harriet territory, junk bonds, speculative grade.
These companies have massive debt loads, unstable cash flows, and high default risk. But they offer massive potential returns to compensate for that terror.
And this leads us directly to the concept of yield spreads.
Yield spreads, explain that.
The yield spread is a very simple metric. It is the difference in yield between a corporate bond and a perfectly comparable U.S. Treasury bond of the same maturity.
Okay, give me an example.
Let's say a 10-year Treasury is paying a safe 4%, and a 10-year junk bond from a struggling airline is paying 9%. The spread is exactly 5%.
Simple subtraction. 9 minus 4 is 5.
Right.
Why do analysts care so much about spreads? Why do they track them constantly?
Because yield spreads act as a real-time psychological barometer for economic fear.
The fear gauge.
Exactly. During healthy, booming economic times, investors feel incredibly confident. They look at that struggling airline and think, the economy is great, people are flying, they won't go bankrupt.
So what happens to the spread?
Because they aren't afraid, they don't demand as much extra compensation to take on the risk. So the yield on the junk bond drops from 9% to maybe 6%. The spread narrows from 5% to 2%.
But what happens during a severe macroeconomic crisis?
Yeah.
A global pandemic? Or a massive banking collapse.
Absolute visceral panic. Investors suddenly realize default risk is real. They look at that airline, realize nobody is flying, and demand massive, massive compensation for taking on the risk of the airline going under.
And at the same time, they're probably buying treasuries to hide, right?
Yes. Simultaneously, they are selling their corporate bonds and fleeing to the absolute safety of U.S. treasuries, driving treasury yields down.
So the two yields are moving in opposite directions.
Right. As the price of corporate bonds collapses due to selling pressure, their yields skyrocket to maybe 12% or 15%. The spread widens significantly.
So if you see an exam question asking what happens to yield spreads during times of severe economic stress or recession, the answer is always, unconditionally, that they widen.
They widen. The fear gauge expands.
Okay, let's talk about the absolute worst case scenario.
Yeah.
The fear becomes reality. The company completely fails. They file Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Liquidation.
It happens.
They are literally selling off the office desks, the delivery trucks, and the staplers just to scrape together cash to pay people back. What is the priority?
Yeah.
Who gets paid first and who is left holding a completely empty bag?
This is called liquidation priority, and it follows a strict, legally mandated hierarchy.
Okay, who is number one?
Number one at the very front of the line, secured creditors.
What makes them secured?
These are bondholders whose debt is legally backed by a specific tangible asset. Think of a mortgage bond backed by a specific factory building or an equipment trust certificate backed by a fleet of airplanes.
So if the company fails, these bondholders have a legal claim to seize that specific factory or those specific airplanes, sell them, and get their money back.
They get paid first.
That makes sense. They hold the deed. Who is number two?
Unsecured creditors, also formerly known as debenture holders.
Debentures.
Yes. Their bonds have no specific collateral attached. They are backed only by the general creditworthiness and reputation of the company. It's just a signed promise.
Because they have no hard assets to seize, they are second in line. They get whatever cash is left over after the secured creditors take their cut.
Right.
Okay, who is number three?
Subordinated debenture holders. The word subordinated literally translates to junior or lower in rank.
So they volunteered to be lower down.
Exactly. When these investors bought the bond, they explicitly signed a contract agreeing to get paid after the regular unsecured debenture holders. They accepted a lower priority in exchange for a higher yield.
Okay. And after we exhaust all those layers of debt, we move across the spectrum from creditors to owners.
From debt to equity, right? Yes. The creditors are paid, and now we look at the owners of the company. Number four in line is preferred stockholders.
And last.
Dead last. At the very bottom of the barrel, number five, is the common stockholders. In a true liquidation scenario, by the time the lawyers and the creditors are done picking the carcass of the company clean, the common stockholders are usually completely wiped out.
The value of their shares just goes to zero.
Usually zero.
Okay. Exam trap flag. Stop what you are doing. This is a foundational rule you cannot ever forget. The exam writers know this list is easy to memorize, so they will try to trick you using descriptive adjectives.
They love their adjectives.
They will invent a completely fictional security with a ridiculous name like a super senior double platinum preferred stock and ask you if it gets paid before a junior subordinated unsecured debenture. What is the unbreakable rule?
The rule is absolute and overrides all adjectives. Debt always comes before equity.
Debt before equity.
A bondholder is a creditor who lent the company money. A stockholder is an owner who took an equity risk. Creditors always legally get paid before owners.
So a junior, subordinated, lowest-tier debenture bond will always beat the most senior, fancy-sounding preferred stock.
Always. Every single time.
Drill that into your mind. Debt beats equity. Period. No exceptions. Okay, what about some of the special weird features that could be hidden inside that massive corporate indenture? Let's talk about convertible bonds.
Convertible bonds are fascinating hybrids. They start their life as a standard corporate bond, paying regular interest, but they contain a hidden option.
What's the option?
They can be swapped at the investor's discretion for a fixed, predetermined number of shares of the issuing company's common stock.
It gives you the downside protection and steady income of a bond, but the explosive upside potential of a stock.
It's the ultimate fence-sitting investment.
But the exam trap is understanding the motivations. Why would a company offer such a sweet deal? And why does Harriet buy it?
Harriet buys it for the equity lottery ticket. She wants the chance to get rich if the company invents a new blockbuster product.
And the company?
The company offers it for a very specific financial reason. It allows them to issue the bond with a significantly lower coupon rate.
Ah, they save money on interest.
That conversion feature has intrinsic mathematical value. So the investor willingly accepts less interest cash flow today in exchange for that lottery ticket for tomorrow.
If the stock moons, Harriet converts the bond to stock, sells it, and makes a fortune.
And if the stock tanks and becomes worthless, she just shrugs, holds on to it as a standard bond, and continues collecting her lower interest checks until maturity.
It is the best of both worlds, but you pay for that privilege with a lower yield. Now, what about corporate zero coupon bonds?
Mechanically, these function exactly like the treasury strips we discussed earlier. They're issued at a deep discount, they pay absolutely zero periodic interest, and they mature at par value.
And because they are zero coupon, wait, let me guess. Phantom income strikes again, right?
Exactly right. Phantom income is back.
Yeah. Even though it's a corporate bond, the IRS rules still apply. You are taxed annually on the accretion of that discount, even though you get zero cash until maturity.
So just like strips, you want to keep corporate zero coupon bonds hidden safely inside a tax-deferred retirement account.
Okay, keep the phantoms in the IRA. Got it. And the last corporate feature we need to dissect, sinking funds. What exactly is a sinking fund provision?
A sinking fund is a safety provision written into the indenture where the issuing corporation is legally required to systematically set aside money periodically.
Where do they put it?
Usually into an escrow account managed by the trustee. They use this money to retire portions of the total debt before the final maturity date arrives.
How do they retire it early?
They might use that cash to call certain bonds at par value, buy them back in the open secondary market if they are trading at a discount, or use a randomized lottery system to pull certain bond certificates out of circulation.
So we have two very different investors. Who loves the sinking fund and who despises it? Cautious Carl or High Yield Harriet?
Oh, Cautious Carl absolutely loves the sinking fund.
Why?
From a credit perspective, a sinking fund drastically lowers the default risk of the bond. Why? Because the company is slowly, methodically paying down its massive debt burden over time.
Instead of facing a terrifying multi-billion-dollar balloon payment all at once in 10 years.
Exactly. It proves they have the cash flow to service their debt.
But Harriet hates it. Why?
Harriet hates it because it introduces massive reinvestment risk and aggressively caps her upside potential.
Give me a scenario.
Imagine Harriet bought a 9% high-yield bond. She loves it. But then her specific bond certificate gets selected in the sinking fund's random lottery, and the company forcibly calls her bond away at par value.
Oh, man.
She loses her amazing 9% investment and is thrust back into the open market, forced to find a new place to put her money, probably at much lower current interest rates.
And what if the bond was trading at a premium?
That's the other issue. If her bond was highly desirable and trading at a premium in the open market, say it was worth $1,050, and the company calls it via the sinking fund at the $1,000 par value, she instantly loses that $50 of extra market value.
It caps the upside and introduces reinvestment risk. Sinking funds equal lower credit risk, higher reinvestment risk.
Exactly.
Let's move to our final section. Section 5, the spice rack. Asset-backed and foreign securities. This is where things get really creative. Let's start with asset-backed securities, or ABS.
Think back to the sprawling suburban neighborhood analogy we used for mortgage-backed securities earlier. We bundled 1,000 mortgages.
Right.
ABS used the exact same financial alchemy, pooling thousands of small loans together and selling slices to investors, but they specifically use assets other than real estate mortgages.
Right. So we are talking about securitizing the rest of American life. Auto loans, credit card receivables, student loans, home equity loans.
Exactly. Let's build a scenario using auto loans. Imagine a massive national bank has just originated 10,000 individual auto loans.
Okay, 10,000 cars.
They have 10,000 different people driving around in sedans and trucks, each paying the bank $400 a month for the next 5 years. But the bank doesn't want to wait 5 years to collect all those $400 checks.
They want a massive lump sum of cash now so they can go issue more loans, and generate more origination fees.
So they bundle the 10,000 car loans and securitize them. But here is the critical, legally complex, structural piece that the exam loves to test, the SPV.
Special purpose vehicle. Why does the bank need to create an entirely new entity? Why can't they just sell the bundle of car loans directly to investors from their own balance sheet?
The SPV is the absolute secret sauce of securitization. It is a completely separate, legally distinct corporate entity created specifically and solely to hold these 10,000 loans.
So they move the loans.
The bank legally sells and transfers the 10,000 auto loans out of its own portfolio and into the SPV. The SPV, now holding the loans, issues the ABS bonds to the public investors.
And the why here is a concept called bankruptcy remoteness. Explain how that protects the investor.
Let's look at a catastrophic scenario. Let's say the originating bank made terrible bets elsewhere and goes totally bankrupt.
The regulators move in, padlock the doors, and the CEO is in handcuffs.
Right. If the investors had bought the bonds directly from the bank, those 10,000 auto loans would be considered assets of the bank, and they would get tied up in a messy bankruptcy court for years while lawyers fought over who gets the cash.
But because the loans were legally moved to the separate SPV?
They are bankruptcy remote.
Hmm.
The SPV is in a totally different building, metaphorically speaking. It just keeps humming along, collecting the $400 car payments and passing the cash to the investors completely, 100% unaffected by the bank's spectacular failure.
It built an impenetrable legal fortress around the asset pool. That is brilliant. Now, exam trap flag. The exam writers will give you a multiple choice list of specific securities and ask which one is classified as an ABS.
And they will almost always include a mortgage-backed security in that list just to tempt you. Do not take the bait.
ABS are strictly defined as non-mortgage assets.
If it's backed by a house, it's an MBS. If it's backed by a car, a credit card, or a student loan, it's an ABS.
But remember the human element.
Yeah.
Both of them are subject to prepayment risk because people can pay off their car loans early or consolidate their credit cards, just like they refinance mortgages.
Humans are unpredictable across the board.
Okay, let's look at the absolute final frontier, foreign-issued bonds. This is the scenario where cautious Carl gets incredibly adventurous, decides he wants higher yields than U.S. Treasuries, and decides to buy debt issued by a completely different country.
Sovereign debt or foreign corporate debt?
By crossing a border, what massive new layers of risk is he taking on?
He is adding two massive, unpredictable new layers, sovereign risk and currency risk. Let's start with sovereign risk, which is basically extreme political risk.
Right, because if I buy a bond from the U.S. government, I know the rules.
Yeah.
We have a constitution. If I buy a corporate bond from a U.S. company and they default, I can drag their CEO into a federal bankruptcy court in Delaware and demand they liquidate assets to pay me.
But what happens if a foreign national government defaults?
There is no global bankruptcy court for sovereign nations, is there?
Exactly. You can't send a repo man to repossess a country. Let's look at history. In the late 90s and early 2000s, countries like Russia and Argentina simply defaulted on their sovereign debt.
And if you buy debt from an emerging market country and a new regime takes power in a revolution and simply decrees that they're not going to honor the previous government's capitalist debts, you are entirely out of luck.
Sovereign risk encompasses political instability, massive changes in economic policy, and frankly, just the willingness of the country to pay.
We've decided we don't feel like paying you, and there's not a single thing a U.S. investor can do about it.
Recovery of your funds depends entirely on complex diplomatic negotiations and IMF restructurings, not a structured, predictable court process.
And then, even if the country is perfectly stable, there's currency risk, the exchange rate teeter-totter.
Right. Let's say I buy a sovereign bond denominated in euros. It pays me a very reliable 50 euros a month.
But you live in the United States. You can't walk into your local grocery store and buy milk with euros.
You are forced to take that 50 euros and convert it back into U.S. dollars every single month in the foreign exchange market.
Currency risk is the constant looming danger that the exchange rate moves against you between the time you buy the bond and the time you collect the interest.
Okay, let's map this mechanism out very clearly because it confuses people.
If the euro gets stronger relative to the dollar, meaning it suddenly takes more U.S. dollars to buy one single euro, is that a good thing for me or a bad thing for me?
That is fantastic for you. You want the foreign currency to strengthen. A stronger foreign currency means when you take your 50 euros to the exchange window, you get more U.S. dollars handed back to you. Your actual return, measured in dollars, increases.
But if the euro weakens and the U.S. dollar gets incredibly strong, My 50 euros buys fewer and fewer dollars. My return shrinks, even though the bond itself is performing perfectly.
Right, so you face two distinct overlapping risks. The bond itself could lose value due to interest rates, and the currency could move against you and wipe out your yield.
Now, because this is the Series 65, we have specific terminology to identify how these foreign bonds are structured. We need to define euro bonds and Yankee bonds. Let's start with euro bonds.
A euro bond is a bond issued in a currency that is different from the currency of the country where it is actually issued and sold.
Give me an example of that.
Imagine a bond denominated entirely in US dollars, but it is issued and sold by a syndicate of banks in London to European investors. Despite the confusing name Eurobond, it has absolutely nothing to do with the euro currency or Europe specifically. It just means external currency.
The name is terrible. But the really important one, the highly testable one, is the Yankee bond. Direct question to you, the listener.
Think about Cautious Carl here.
Cautious Carl wants to buy a corporate bond from a massive, stable Japanese electronics company. He wants the slightly higher yield they offer. But he is absolutely terrified of the Japanese yen fluctuating against the US dollar.
He hates currency risk.
He wants the foreign exposure, but he demands zero currency risk.
Yeah.
What specific structural type of bond does he look for? He buys a Yankee bond.
Exactly. A Yankee bond is a foreign bond that is explicitly issued inside the U.S. market, registered with the SEC, and most importantly, it is denominated entirely in U.S. dollars.
So mechanically, the Japanese electronics company comes to Wall Street in New York, issues the bond to U.S. investors, collects U.S. dollars, and signs a contract promising to pay Carl his interest and principal back in U.S. dollars.
Precisely. The Japanese company takes on all the headache. They have to worry about the yen-to-dollar exchange rate when they scramble to make those dollar payments, but Carl doesn't.
He just sits back and gets his checks in plain old dollars.
Yeah.
For the U.S. investor, a Yankee bond completely, 100%, eliminates currency risk.
It's the safest way to go global.
Okay, my brain is officially full. We have covered a massive amount of foundational knowledge today. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the most highly testable, crucial concepts from this deep dive. I'll start us off.
Let's do it.
Tax treatment comparison. U.S. treasuries are exempt from state and local taxes, but you pay federal. Agency securities like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are fully taxable at all levels.
Government backing. GNMA, Ginny Mae, is the only mortgage agency with the explicit, full faith and credit backing of the U.S. government. Fannie and Freddie are implied only.
The seesaw of doom. Prepayment risk and extension risk move in exact opposite directions. Falling interest rates cause a frenzy of prepayments. Rising rates cause an agonizing extension of maturity.
Municipal bonds. General obligation JEGO bonds require voter approval because they put the taxpayers on the hook. Revenue bonds do not require a vote because they are backed solely by project funds like tolls.
Phantom income. TIPS, strips, and zero coupon corporate bonds all generate terrifying phantom income. You owe taxes on the mathematical growth annually, even though you get zero actual cash until maturity. Hide them in an IRA.
Liquidation priority in a bankruptcy. Debt always beats equity. Any type of creditor or bondholder gets paid before any type of stockholder. Subordinated debt still beats preferred stock.
And finally, Yankee bonds. Issued by foreign entities operating in the U.S., denominated entirely in U.S. dollars. They completely eliminate currency risk for the U.S. investor.
That is a rock-solid, comprehensive recap, and I want to leave you with a final, slightly provocative thought to chew on as you continue to study this dense material.
Lay it on us.
We started this entire discussion by defining U.S. Treasuries as the ultimate, pristine, risk-free baseline, zero default risk. But think critically about the mechanics we just learned.
Okay.
If you buy a 30-year treasury strip, you are voluntarily taking on the most extreme volatile interest rate risk possible in the bond market. Your principal will swing wildly.
That's true.
If you buy TIPS to safely avoid inflation, you get hit with a phantom income tax drag that literally drains cash from your checking account today.
Right.
So ask yourself, when you step out of the textbook and into the actual living fixed income market, is there really such a thing as a truly risk-free investment? Or are you always constantly just choosing which specific flavor of risk you're most willing to swallow?
Oof. The X-ray machine is definitely permanently broken. That's a phenomenal question to mull over. You cannot escape risk. You can only identify it, measure it, and decide how to manage it. To everyone listening, thank you for taking this deep dive with us today.
It was a big one.
Keep grinding through the material. Keep asking why the rules operate the way they do. And you're going to absolutely crush your Series 65 exam. You are exceptionally well equipped to navigate the muddy waters of the fixed income landscape now. We'll catch you on the next one.